Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Ooh, yeah. And it's October.
There are plenty of traces below the surface. I'm not sure which reality we're going with. No, wait. There's only one for Catholic. We got it.
That's right. We're going to talk today about The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. Excellent. Published 1886.
Yeah.
In London. Yeah.
Yeah. Around Dickens time then.
Yeah. A little after. Post Dickens, right?
Yeah.
I think it was like 20 years post Dickens.
Right.
So that's great.
Right. Yeah. So we know where we are.
That's right. And a very interesting origin story to this novel.
Yes, this is one that came to Stevenson. I almost said Jekyll. Not that I'm too into the book. Came to Stevenson in a dream. He'd been sick, and he had a brain hemorrhage or something. He was always very weakly. He was sickly and weak. And but his wife one night heard him screaming in his sleep, and so she woke him up, and she said, he said, "Why did you wake me up? I was having such a fine bogey dream."
A bogey dream. That's cool.
Yeah, he'd been dreaming the first transformation of Dr. Jekyll. So he woke up the next morning, and even though he wasn't supposed to do anything because of his illness, he wrote for 3 days solid and wrote the story out. And then he gave it to his wife, who he trusted to read everything. And she gave it back and said, "Well, you know, this is a fine story, but you've missed a lot of the point. This is an allegory. This is a morality tale in a sense, and you haven't written any of that in there. You just wrote some scary stuff. Who cares?" And so that afternoon, he called her upstairs and said, "Look," or something like that. He points at the fireplace, and there's just these ashes.
Oh, wow.
And she's, I can't remember if it's a letter.
That's horrifying. Oh, man.
Journal. Yes. And she's like, "I was so horrified. I didn't mean that."
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm. But what he did then was take another 3 days or 6 days and rewrite it. And what he wrote was basically this story. And then over the next 4 to 6 weeks, he honed it and tweaked it.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
I like it.
Yeah, I like the idea that he trusted his wife as a sounding board like that. Even if he didn't like what she said, he trusted it.
Yeah. Yeah, and he threw the whole thing out and then redid it better, I assume.
Yeah, well,
one hopes.
And
was willing to do that. Yeah, and one hopes.
Well, his stepson said that for like several weeks, you just couldn't even, you had to tiptoe. He was so angry.
Ooh.
Uh-huh. Just like, okay. I can't blame him.
Oh, but, wow.
But what this story is, I think it's short, but it's so, such a masterpiece. He got so much into it because it's only about 100 pages.
Yeah, mine was 80 pages, you know, in the size book that I had, but yeah. You're right. It was very, I don't know, the setting was perfect, you know, and it was a good murder mystery. Yeah.
And a horror story.
Yeah, and a horror story. But yeah, most of all a horror story. But, you know, as modern readers, you know, we really know what's up.
Right.
So, you know, I'm imagining that people back then reading it and not knowing what was up and saying, "My goodness," you know, or whatever at the end. But, you know, Jekyll and Hyde is so ingrained in our, it's just a cultural thing, right? I mean, we use the term all the time.
Right.
So everybody kind of knows what that means, even if they haven't read the book. And if they haven't read the book, they don't quite have it right, I don't think.
Yeah, because and I'd forgotten this because I hadn't read it for a while, is it starts off from Mr. Utterson's point of view. He is a lawyer. And actually, he tells most of the story until you get to the spot where in the finest style of the time, there are two different narratives from first person from different people that are read that explain everything. But Mr. Utterson is the one who this gives you an idea of Stevenson's style. If you don't mind if I read just the first paragraph.
Please do.
Because I think Mr. Utterson is the one everything is framed against, since it's his point of view, and that makes him interesting, or more interesting than you'd think. Mr. Utterson, the lawyer, was a man of a rugged countenance that was never lighted by a smile, cold, scanty, and embarrassed in discourse, backward in sentiment, lean, long, dusty, dreary, and yet somehow lovable. At friendly meetings, and when the wine was to his taste, something eminently human beaconed from his eye, something indeed which never found its way into his talk, but which spoke not only in these silent symbols of the after-dinner face, but more often and loudly in the acts of his life. He was austere with himself, drank gin when he was alone to mortify a taste for vintages, and though he enjoyed the theater, had not crossed the doors of one for 20 years. But he had an approved tolerance for others, sometimes wondering, almost with envy, at the high pressure of spirits involved in their misdeeds, and in any extremity inclined to help rather than to reprove. And actually, just a little further on, it says, in this character, it was frequently his fortune to be the last reputable acquaintance and the last good influence in the lives of downgoing men.
Yeah, right before that, he says, I incline to Cain's heresy, he used to say quaintly. I let my brother go to the devil in his own way. And then, therefore, you know, in this character, it was frequently his fortune.
Right, I guess I should have just read that sentence.
Yeah.
And then the very last sentence of the paragraph, we'll just finish it out. It says, and to such as these, so long as they came about his chambers, he never marked a shade of change in his demeanor. So this is a really admirable guy who, what I liked is the after dinner and when he's had a few drinks, that's when the human stuff comes out. So you know how they'll say your weaknesses or your true self comes out when you're kind of loosened up? With him, it's that he's so human and so caring in his acts of his fellow man.
Yeah, and that's interesting. They're saying, make sure you read this the same way I do, and to such as these, so long as they came about his chambers, he never marked a shade of change in his demeanor, meaning that he was the same no matter who he was with.
Right, because the lives of downgoing men who he was the last good influence to, when they came, he never acted any different.
Right.
And so,
and that is an admirable quality, I think.
Yeah, and so you've got this really admirable guy who, although he's kind of cold-seeming, down deep, there's this real human side of him, and that's what makes him act that way. And so you're told the story from his point of view till the end, and what the mystery, as you're saying, and in fact, I was really interested to see how it was framed as a mystery, is that he and another friend of his are walking, and they hardly ever talk a lot of the time. They're such, I guess, quiet people, and also they've been around each other so much, and they're out for a walk. And one of them says, I could tell you a story about that door. Isn't that it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like the chapter is called The Story of a Door. And so he tells about somebody who came out and was walking along a corner so fast, or walking toward a corner. And along the other corner, where you couldn't see around the side of the building, was coming a child. And they bumped into each other. And any normal person would stop and pick the kid up or at least step around them. He just tromp right on the kid. Keeps going.
Yeah.
And everybody stops him because they see it happening, the parents and some other people. And he finally says, all right, I'll give you some money to pay for the doctor, you know. And so that's how we meet who we later discover is Mr. Hyde.
Right.
And Mr. Hyde pays for the damages, essentially, with a check signed by
Dr. Jekyll. That's right, yeah.
Who is a friend of these two men. And they're like, what is the connection? And so Mr. Utterson becomes so curious, he stakes out the door. Or, well, he actually talks to his friend first, Dr. Jekyll. He's like, don't worry about it. I know what I'm doing. And then he stakes out the door to see what he can find out. And so in the process of finding out, Dr. Jekyll begins acting more and more oddly. He meets Mr. Hyde, who everyone who meets him says, oh, I just couldn't stand him. There was something about him that was repulsive. And but they're very clearly different people.
Right. Yep.
Mr. Hyde is smaller.
He's even shorter. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and very different looking than Dr. Jekyll. And, of course, we all know the story, so I guess it's not spoiling anything. But you don't discover what really is happening until you're reading the two narratives at the end, which is of a doctor friend of theirs and who sees the transformation, in fact, has to help him without knowing what's going on. And then Mr. Jekyll, or Dr. Jekyll, sorry, his confession, essentially. And in this 100 pages, what becomes pretty clear is you're looking at Stevenson thinking about, of course, this great story, because we know he started off to write just a great story. But when he stopped and thought about it more deeply, he started telling a story about good and evil, which our culture has translated in a million different ways as the sign of the times needs it, really.
Yeah, agreed. Yep.
And I don't know what else you'd like to say.
Without exposing, I mean, every detail, you know, it's really good as a synopsis for sure. Okay. But I really liked how in the first two thirds of the novel is everything that you're describing. And then, you know, that's where the mystery is, you know, and I call it a novel, I guess it's a novella or whatever.
But
so everything that you're describing is there. And then the last third of the novel is called Henry Jekyll's Full Statement of the Case. And so after everything is revealed, then you basically read Henry Jekyll's version of what happened, as if it was a journal entry or as if he was, you know, telling someone the whole thing. And fascinating. It was great, you know. So
I know, because it changes the whole tone of everything.
It does.
But you're just still sucked in by the whole thing. I mean, Stevenson,
it's like two stories, you know. You're telling the same story twice, but from two different points of view.
Yeah, he's masterful in how he tells this.
It's very well done. Very well done. And you know, Henry Jekyll, you know, gets philosophical and, you know, he is, you know, full of himself, you know, but, you know, we'll definitely talk about that. But really cool how this is put together. I liked how it was done.
And you said you hadn't read it before, right?
No, this was my first time. Yeah. Yeah. And there were assumptions, you know, I come into the thing with cultural assumptions, and my biggest thing, my biggest surprise, I guess, was that this was not good and evil in that Jekyll was all good and Hyde was all evil. You know, the counterpoint to Hyde was not Jekyll.
Yeah.
Right. And that was a surprise to me.
I know. I guess it's really, Hyde is pretty evil.
Yeah, definitely. But, I mean, they're talking satanic.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny because saying that Jekyll isn't all, you know, good and Hyde isn't all evil. Well, Hyde actually kind of is all evil, but Jekyll is not all good. And that's really interesting. That you would think, you know, modern times, because, you know, we were talking about pop culture, is you think of the famous Star Trek episode where Captain Kirk threw a transporter malfunction, as so many things are.
that darn transporter.
It's a metaphysical transporter, I can say. But he's split into two. So you have his good half and his bad half. And it's all good and all bad. Although I guess the way they saw it was, how do good and bad color your personality? Because the good Shatner, good Captain Kirk, was weak and indecisive.
Right. In fact, he was non-functional, right? Well, they were both non-functional, right?
Right.
Yeah. So you had to have both the halves. You know, the good wasn't strong enough to make a decision which maybe could offend somebody. I don't know. Or maybe afraid of offending.
I haven't watched it for a while, but I think he couldn't choose between all the possibilities that could happen. I mean,
and so you needed this evil side to do that, which is an interesting statement.
Yeah, and the evil side was considered to be strong and decisive because he didn't really care about any of that other stuff. And I'm trying to remember what made him take it back. I think Mr. Spock worked a logic thing on him, going, you know, come on. You're never going to get anywhere being all bad. That's just how it's going
to
be.
Way to go, Spock.
Yeah.
He saved it for the rest of us.
As always, he's the Mr. Utterson of the group, I would say.
Right. So the counterpoint really is Mr. Utterson, right? Now, you read the description of Utterson. I'm just going to read that again real quick. Mr. Utterson, the lawyer, was a man of rugged countenance that was never lighted by a smile, cold, scanty, and embarrassed in discourse. Backward in sentiment, lean, long, dusty, dreary, and yet somehow lovable.
And they then only missed the pointed ears.
Exactly. And then if we describe Jekyll, this is him describing himself. And he says, "And indeed, the worst of my faults was a certain impatient gaiety of disposition, such as has made the happiness of many, but such as I found it hard to reconcile with my imperious desire to carry my head high and wear a more than commonly grave countenance before the public." Right? So, I think that's interesting. It's almost as if Utterson and Jekyll are opposites to begin with.
Or halves of each other. That's interesting. So when we talk about good and evil, we always think Jekyll and Hyde, but in this case, it actually tends to be more Utterson and Jekyll. Okay, because now I want to dive into something.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, everybody. This is it. We're going deeper.
Here we go. Jumping in.
Because that's the dual nature. Oh, crud. Now I've forgotten it. I know what I was going to say is because the other thing that's opposite is even though Jekyll is, you know, he wants to look good in front of everybody, even though he does things that he won't tell you, he doesn't describe what they are. You're allowed to just think of the awful things for yourself that he would like to do. But he goes it alone. He doesn't ask for help. He doesn't confide in anyone. He's not telling his secrets. He's kind of hugging them to himself, which I was shocked, frankly. I thought he was, in my bad memory of this book, I thought he was pretty good and he wanted to get rid of the evil. No, he wants to enjoy the evil a lot more, which is horrible. And then you've got Utterson, who is all about, I'll help you out. I won't, you know, I'll never tell anybody your secrets, but you can tell them to me. I will help you. And at one point he says to Jekyll, come on, man, just tell me. I'll help you work through it. It'll be okay.
Yeah.
And so he's really the opposite. He's reaching out to people and part of a community of people, whether they talk or not on their walks is one thing, but they do those walks all the time.
That's right. Yeah.
And Jekyll's shutting himself away.
Right. So, yeah. So Jekyll's, you know, description of his faults is that he has a certain impatient gaiety of disposition, right? And the other guy is, you know, right. Utterson is embarrassed in discourse, which I think means he's shy. He doesn't
want
to speak out loud very much, which is odd for a lawyer. And then the rugged countenance of Mr. Utterson versus the more than commonly grave countenance of Jekyll, as again, self-described.
Well, also Jekyll, though, says, hence it came about because he's like, I always wanted to hold my head high and look pretty good in front of everybody, you know, that commonly grave countenance. And, of course, we're talking about Victorian times, so reputation would have been very important. But it says, hence it came about that I concealed my pleasures and that when I reached years of reflection and began to look around me and take stock of my progress and position in the world, I stood already committed to a profound duplicity of life. Many a man would have even blazoned such irregularities as I was guilty of, but from the high views that I had set before me, I regarded and hid them with an almost morbid sense of shame. It was thus rather the exacting nature of my aspirations than any particular degradation in my faults that made me what I was. And with even a deeper trench than in the majority of men, severed in me those provinces of good and evil which divide and compound man's dual nature. And then we get a little philosophy. But
right. So I think he's commenting a bit on Victorian culture, too.
Oh.
At the same time.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so he's like, you know, we're all pretending to be these people that we're not. And Jekyll is, you know, perhaps a more extreme version of that. And then him, you know, because he says, you know, I do different things alone than I do in public. Mm-hmm. And then Hyde seems to be the removal of the desire to be a certain person in public.
Yeah.
right?
He lets it all hang out.
But it's yeah. He's more evil, I would assume. He's more evil than Jekyll is.
Well, right? Yes, because at one point, finally, once he's murdered somebody, that's when Jekyll's like, oh, holy moly, what's...
Right, no, he has a problem with that, right? And it's not just that he's going to get caught. Yeah.
No more Hyde, no more ever. This went too far. But the thing is that what he says is he enjoyed the bad stuff and he wanted to do it more or feel better about it, you know. And that's kind of why he started his scientific studies about this dual nature within himself. And I thought, yeah, how interesting of Stevenson to look at that dual nature, because we've all got that struggle that even St. Paul said it, right? I should have looked the quote up, but it's, why do I do the things I don't want to do?
Yeah.
You know, the flesh is weak.
Yeah.
And so Utterson, though, by regular mortification, he'll drink gin instead of wine. So it's not that he won't have a drink, but he loves the vintages of wine and he's not crazy about gin. So he's like, well, if I have to drink, I'll have something that kind of helps me hang, you know, the straight and narrow.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. He's austere with himself. Hadn't been to a theater for a while. So
it's like a self-denial. And discipline. Yeah, it's interesting you call that mortification. That's interesting. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think he did call it that.
Oh, did he call it that? Okay. If he did, I missed that word. But
yeah, he
it's
was
like
austere
a denier of your denial of your desires, right?
Yeah, drank gin when he was alone to mortify a taste for vintages, said.
Okay.
But he tolerated others, even when they did things from high spirits that they shouldn't have done. And so I'm like, wow, he's a much better person, because they don't go into this later, because he says through his acts, you know, he shows who he is more than any description. And so then when he's watching the door to see who Mr. Hyde is, it's partly out of curiosity. And he's funny because he goes, well, I'll be Mr. Seek to his Mr. Hyde. But it's really because he's worried about his friend who won't confide in him. And he's worried he's gotten himself in too deep.
Yeah. And that's what brings him into the thing in the first place, is he's got this will, right? And he thinks the will is very odd and must have been under coercion or something.
You know, that's right.
Yeah, so that's why he started, you know, the deeper interest in the first place. Because he's like, there's just something wrong with this.
Right.
I better go find out what's going on.
That's it.
Yeah.
I left that part out. But yeah, so there's that whole idea of duality. And what's interesting is this came after Frankenstein, where you have somebody who's created a purely innocent being who's innocent at first. But they're two creatures. They're two people. And this is the first time that it's the same person.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. And we've seen a lot of those since then. You know, we mentioned the Star Trek, and there's, you know, the Incredible Hulk, and Batman has Two-Face, and as I've been told. And there's, you know, all these various things. So we all know it now, but he was the first one to really do that. And even before, although it was kind of roiling around, as I understand, in thinking at the time. I mean, Freud hadn't written any of his stuff yet. So he was on the cusp of just looking at, what is it in us that makes us divided, that we have to struggle with ourselves?
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing to think about, too. And yeah, I wonder, you know, well, that's what confession helps do, is keep us whole, right? You know, keep us from having to suppress something, you know, for so long that it becomes, that you become, you know, I was going to say that too, you know, that's the happiest that you are in life, I think, is when you're in a relationship in which you have none of those secrets, which makes you something to a person, you know, and that relationship could be a spouse or a friend or at work or whatever. But if you have lied or done something that means that whenever you're around this person, you now have to be different than you are.
Mm-hmm.
That down that road is difficulty, you know,
yeah.
And that's duality that I think we all have experienced anyway.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that the happiest relationships are the ones that don't have any of that. You know, when you're totally open and there isn't any secrets and you don't have to guard yourself in any way that's where it's at.
Right. Which is what we all strive for, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
With our yeah. loved ones or
hopefully
our friends.
Hopefully all our relationships. Right.
I mean, you don't have to, not saying you have to tell everybody everything. You can,
no question.
But and that makes sense because you're saying that and I'm thinking, well, and of course, because if God is the supreme being there is and we want to have a close relationship with him, if that's what we would do with our friends and loved ones, how much more should we do that with him, especially since he already knows what we did.
Yeah.
Half the time we knew what we did. You know, we're like, I'm going to do it anyway. But the other half of the time, I truly think, you know, we realize later what we've done. It's after you've said that thing that has been wrong or, you know, hurt somebody or whatever, and you go, oh, my temper, my whatever.
Mm.
So that going to confession, as you mentioned, that's the, not only do you make it right with your friend or whatever you did wrong, but, you know, that's making it right with your greatest friend who has your greatest good in mind.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was one section where Utterson is talking to Dr. Jekyll that he mentions talking. I'll just read it real quick. He says, "Well, I tell you so again," continued the lawyer, who is Utterson. "I have been learning something of young Hyde." The large, handsome face of Dr. Jekyll grew pale to the very lips, and there came a blackness about his eyes. "I do not care to hear more," said he. "This is a matter I thought we had agreed to drop." "What I heard was abominable," said Utterson. "It can make no change. You do not understand my position," returned the doctor, with a certain incoherency of manner. "I am painfully situated, Utterson. My position is a very strange one. It is one of those affairs that cannot be mended by talking." And, you know, right there he closes himself off and he's like, you know, "I'm not talking to you about this," which
right.
is the wrong thing to do. In a lot of cases.
Well, and I had that right? marked too, because the very next sentence is, "Jekyll," said Utterson, "you know me. I am a man to be trusted. Make a clean breast of this in confidence, and I make no doubt I can get you out of it." And of course, Jekyll turns him down.
Yep.
That's yes.
Utterson offering him help, you know.
Right. And he I think, you know, he thinks he's got it all under control at that point. And how many times do we do that? You know, like, oh, no, I'm fine. Fine.
Yeah. You talk about addiction or, you know,
yeah.
that's another analogy, I guess, or allegory, perhaps, you know, is
exactly,
that Hyde is an
yeah.
addiction. Yeah.
I was thinking that, too, when I was getting ready for this. And I know that's not an original thought, but I just thought, you know, it's that thing of you're just begging. I want to help you. There's something very wrong. The person's like, nope. And I thought, you know, even if he'd said, yes, I do need help. I want you to help me, which at the end he's asking for, but it's way too late. Then could Utterson have helped him? Because we know from reading his confession or whatever it was he called it, that deep down, he really couldn't, he enjoyed doing that bad stuff.
Hmm.
Because when he, toward the end, he finds, you know, once he's horrified by Jekyll murdering, or I mean Hyde murdering, because what happens is he'll tamp him down and go, well, I'm not letting you out again for a while. And then he'll, well, just one more time. And then he says it roars forth stronger than ever for having been held back. And somebody, he murders somebody, takes great joy in beating him to death, which is terrible.
Yeah.
And that's what horrifies him so much. He's like, nope, never doing that again. But he will then wake up and find himself turned into Hyde without wanting to. So the evil part has become the true part. And he has to drink the potion to turn himself back into Jekyll more and more.
Yeah. Yep. And then he runs out of salt. Poor guy.
Here's the ironic thing, of course, mm-hmm. you know, clever Stevenson, is that he's like, this isn't pure. And he goes, oh, man, I've realized the first batch that made everything work was impure. And I'm like, of course it was. It wasn't what it should have been, was it? It's like, oh.
And he can never find another impure source or whatever. Yeah, that was neat.
Yeah, because one of the things I liked is when the last time he changes, he's just sitting on a park bench and he'd been really good for a long time. And the thing that's so ironic is he doesn't even really think or do anything that we would think of as bad. He's been doing all these good deeds, and he kind of sits there in the sun going, ah, I'm so much better than my neighbors. I do all these good things, and bam.
Bam. Oh, that is cool.
That's, yeah. You're not really that great, are you, Jekyll? You're gone, man. It's Hyde. And all those tropes of what now tropes, but at the time is like, oh, no, my clothes were too big. My hands looked different. It's all those things you see in horror movies when somebody's trying to hide that, oh, I've changed. How do I hide myself till I can get undercover?
Yeah. Yeah, and the description of Jekyll is really fascinating. You know, somebody asked, I can't remember who is doing this description, but I just have it marked in my Evernote here. Mm-hmm. But it says, he is not easy to describe. There is something wrong with his appearance. Oh, it's Lanyon. Yep.
It's Hyde we're talking about.
Yeah,
not
he's
Jekyll,
talking
right?
about Hyde. And Dr. Lanyon is talking about Hyde.
Yeah.
He is not easy to describe. There is something wrong with his appearance. Something displeasing. Something downright detestable. I never saw a man I so disliked, yet I scarce know why. He must be deformed somewhere. He gives a strong feeling of deformity, although I couldn't specify the point. He's an extraordinary looking man, and yet I really can name nothing out of the way. No, sir, I can make no hand of it. I can't describe him, and it's not want of memory, for I declare I can see him this moment. Interesting. Very slippery, yeah.
Yeah, that there's nothing, it's just something almost emanating from him, some essence of evil.
Right.
That they can't put their fingers on. Well, and this book is really good about, of course, at the time, they were really into that idea of outer architecture reflecting the inner person. And of course, so Hyde, even though he looks normal, there's something off about him. But the architecture, and they say this is really reflected in Edinburgh, which is where Stevenson lived for a really long time. You know, you had the pretty awful old city and then the very nice, neat new city. And I've been there, and you look at some of those little twisty streets, and I'm just like, oh, on a dark night with no streetlights, I can easily imagine, you know, grave robbing and all those awful things that actually happened then. So, and then you look at the new part, and it's all very ordered and laid out nicely, wonderful looking houses. And this is set in London, but a lot of people say, well, surely he was thinking of that, you know. And so you think of where Hyde lives, and it's, you know, not very nice. It's Soho. And it's described as, you know, it's kind of dirty and unsightly, and there's trash blowing around and everything, and awful people everywhere. Well, that reflects what he's like inside. And then Jekyll is living in a very nice house, and he's got servants, and, you know, that's reflecting who he is, too.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah, kind of like in, remember in Uncle Tom's Cabin when, you know, the different houses, like, I can't remember the guy's name. The one who should have set all his slaves free when little Eva died, but didn't. St. Clair.
Right. He didn't enough.
Yeah.
Not soon enough, right?
Yeah, exactly.
He was going to do it, though.
Right. But everything was kind of exotic, but not very well kept, like that Dinah's Kitchen or whatever her name was.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of idea.
Oh, nice.
For the book.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah.
What do you call that? Like geographical... I forgot. I've heard a literary term for that, where, you know, your actual geographical location signifies something, like it did in Uncle Tom's Cabin in here as well. That's neat.
Yeah. Yes, I don't know the word for it, but I felt
I
proud.
I can't remember, so if anyone knows, please help me. Yeah. I really liked one of the things that made me laugh was, remember the butler, as they're getting ready to break into where Mr. Hyde is, but, you know, it's supposed to be Dr. Jekyll.
Right.
And Utterson, right? He's the one who says, okay, I promise you will not get in trouble if you break this door down for me. You know, in that negotiation, the back and forth between those two really made me smile. It was just...
because he came to him because he needed help. He's like, it was Hyde's voice coming out of there. I swear it was, sir. But he won't let me in the door.
Yeah, that was good stuff.
And I know. I love Utterson standing there going, okay, you've done a good job. Now break down that door.
Wow. Everybody needs one of those guys, right? That's fun stuff.
Oh, I know what I was thinking about with the whole addiction thing and then not being able to change himself. And the fact that when he stopped trying, when he stopped being Hyde, you know, said, that's it, no more. He was motivated by fear, not because he wanted to necessarily. I mean, you know, he wanted to, but it's because he was afraid, not because he yearned to be better.
Oh, okay.
You know?
So he wasn't repentant. He was.
Yeah. I mean, he was, but only because, I mean, I don't know. That's how it struck me, because I was thinking about it going, so if the only reason you repent is because you're like, oh my gosh, look at how extreme this was. You know, if he thought he could be Hyde and have the lesser pleasures, whatever those were, would he have cared that much? No. And it made me think of the act of contrition, which I meant to look up and I should have memorized, but sorry, everyone. So, but at one point it says, you know, I'm really sorry I did this, not just because I fear, you know, hell and long for heaven, but because I have offended you, who is all good.
Right.
And so I thought, you know, I guess I thought it was interesting when I thought of it that even the act of contrition is like, you know, being afraid of going to hell is a perfectly good place to start. It's not where, it's not the whole thing, and it's not where you want to wind up, but it's a stepping stone to true internal repentance and a change of intention. And I was like, would this, if Jekyll had turned to Utterson and at least had fear motivating him, would he have eventually been able to have an internal conversion? Of course, we don't know, but.
Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's interesting to consider.
Well, it was for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I like that. You know, you can have both the duality and then, you know, as an addiction, like you said. Yeah, and I know as far as addiction goes, you know, it's not until you really turn that corner that, you know, trying to drop it works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to generally want to not be that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, because it's such a hard struggle even then that otherwise you just give yourself permission.
Yeah. You come up with reasons.
Yeah. Now here I'm talking about.
I say this as an ex-smoker, so it's okay. Not something I haven't been through. I mean, but you know.
Well, I was gonna say I'm saying this thinking about potato chips and ice cream, and we're not gonna talk about how I know about giving in so often.
Yeah.
Moving
yeah.
on. But yeah, it's those are very very tiny examples of addiction, but we all struggle with something like that. I've always been so glad I didn't smoke.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because I just felt like that's just got to be brutal. To quit.
It took a while, but yeah, it's been years and years and years though.
Well, good.
So that is good.
Good for you.
Yeah, thanks. Long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I really liked this book quite a bit. I liked the tone of the whole thing, like I said, and then the shift when we're going to Henry Jekyll's journal. You know, I read that twice, that last third. I liked it so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the whole thing, it works just as a short story by itself. Thought it was good, thought it was great.
Oh yeah, definitely. Well, and I loved, somebody I was reading pointed out that the transformation scene, I mean, this book did so many new things and the transformation scene was one of them because that stuff had never really been described before. And in Dr. Lanyon's narrative, Dr. Lanyon is a common friend and he actually is kind of interesting because he's a more traditional scientist than Dr. Jekyll. And they've obviously in the past, they've had arguments about it because at one point, Utterson is talking to Lanyon and he says, I thought you had a bond of common interest. We had, was the reply from Lanyon. But it is more than 10 years since Henry Jekyll became too fanciful for me. He began to go wrong in mind. And though, of course, I continue to take an interest in him for old time's sake, as they say, I see and I have seen devilish little of the man. Such unscientific balderdash, added the doctor, flushing suddenly purple, would have estranged Damon and Pythias. We're lifelong friends in, I think, Greek mythology or something like that. But anyway, so it was this thing of, it's really ironic, I thought, that the person who Jekyll turns to when he's turned into Hyde and he can't go out and he's going, okay, You're a good friend, and so I'm going to ask you to do this for the sake of friendship, even though now we know they haven't talked for 10 years. Go get a drawer and bring me everything in the drawer, and don't look in the drawer, but but it needs to have these things in it. So only look at those, and then...
Yeah. Yeah, so if you get a note from somebody you haven't heard from a while asking you to bring them a drawer, you should say,
just don't do it.
Not sure yeah. I want to do that. You know, that is another connection between Frankenstein and this is science.
Yeah.
You know, how science was used for the transformation in both Frankenstein's monster and Jekyll into Hyde.
Yeah, that
I don't know again, what significance that has. It's really probably just a questioning of, you know, where the knowledge is going to bring us. You know, as things were changing so fast at that time that they're like, boy, where are we going to be? It's not, you know, I imagine it's not unlike today. Right now we're thinking the same kind of thoughts. Things are moving so quickly that, you know, we have no idea where we're going to be in 10 years.
Well, I saw something saying that they thought that's why there were so many vampire and zombie and all those kind of stories that have kind of taken us over, because we're like that time back then when all those stories came up. We're struggling with a lot of transitions about things that make us very uncertain.
Yeah.
And
the zombies, you've got the removal of all the things that are causing you so much difficulty, right? You know, in society. You're replacing it with something horrible, but it's almost like, okay, everybody's equal now. You know, there's no money anymore. We don't have to worry about that. I think that's what's interesting about erasing society, not specifically zombies, but you destroy it all. And all this stuff that we commonly worry about every day just goes away. We're worried about other things, you know, like food and how to survive. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, or maybe our most basic instincts, but...
Well, and you know, that's interesting because Rose was here last week.
Mm-hmm.
And so she and I had given her some audiobook files and we were looking through some things. And she was talking about, I don't buy many books for my Kindle, but I think I'm going to buy this kind of book maybe for it. And I said, yeah, I don't buy anything for the Kindle that... I said, I realize this is ridiculous, but I've read so much science fiction that if society fails, I can't get to it. I need to have the physical version. And I said, I know I sound ridiculous. And she looked at me and she goes, oh, no, I think of that every time I plug in my iPod and I'm going somewhere. I think if electricity failed, this would be all I'd have on my iPod. And then I could only listen till the big batteries ran out, you know, and I'm like, wow, that says something about how it's permeated our society in terms of literature and pop culture and everything, that we've seen so many apocalyptic stories that we kind of go, huh, what if, about regular life.
Well, I remember Lucifer's Hammer by Larry Niven and Pornell, Jerry Pornell. There was a scene in that book. Ooh, you know what? That might be good for us. But anyway, there was a scene in that book where right after the asteroids hit, one of the scientists, his first reaction was to go bury a bunch of books.
Yes.
Yeah. So
putting in the mothballs. I still remember that scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
Into the Ziploc bags and putting them into the septic tanks.
Exactly. Yeah.
Nobody'd look there.
Right. Right. And they will be there when we need them, you know, to try.
Right.
It's like Foundation from Asimov, right? Which we talked about.
Yeah.
Trying to bootstrap society. Let's not lose everything.
Or The Stand.
Yeah.
That's one of the attractive things about The Stand, is the people who are left are, as you say, you're kind of set free from all these problems that we're mired in now. And so it's kind of like a Robinson Crusoe sort of thing. Yes, you're struggling to just stay alive, but you don't have to worry about when income tax is due or the latest regulation from somewhere.
You know, I don't wonder. I know that for me, that religion does that for me in a way as well. Because... Uh-huh. You know, when you're contemplating that kind of stuff, you know, you're contemplating God and Jesus and how it's eternal and all these things, a lot of things become a lot less significant.
Yeah. So what you said makes me think, I was just reading this quote from C.S. Lewis from a letter he wrote to somebody, and it says, "One last word about getting rid of fear. Two men had to cross a dangerous bridge. The first convinced himself that it would bear them and called this conviction faith. The second said, "Whether it breaks or holds, whether I die here or somewhere else, I am equally in God's good hands." And the bridge did break, and both were killed. And the second man's faith was not disappointed, and the first man's was.
Wow.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Just from a letter.
No, that's, wow, that's something.
I know, I loved it, because I thought, yeah, it's that perfect expression of what is your faith in?
Yes, that's right. Wow. Yeah. No, that's blew me away. I really like that. I'm going to need to write that down.
I know. I will. Mm-hmm. I will send it to you.
Please do. Please do.
Yeah, it's just from a letter. This actually from, I'll just take a moment to plug this Bible. It's called the C.S. Lewis Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And which sounds, as somebody said, they didn't think C.S. Lewis himself would ever approve of it. But basically, it's just the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible in a very nice hardback format. And I think it's on the Kindle also. But throughout it, at appropriate moments, are scattered all these quotes from letters, from books. And they've really chosen well. And I was kind of dubious, but Brandon Vaught, and we'll have to link to his website.
Okay.
He had reviewed it, and he said it's really just kind of like reading a commentary. You know, it's not as if somebody's glorifying C.S. Lewis and going, he's the only one who can talk about it, but just reading him kind of puts things into perspective in these cases, and I really like it.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so great.
Just FYI, everybody.
All right.
But yeah, so that
whole thing. Yeah, so you got to be that second guy.
Yeah, exactly. Which is just what you were saying.
Well, yeah, well, of course.
You're the second guy already.
Try to be the second guy.
Natch.
Good for me.
Well, yeah, that's the struggle, is to be the second guy. We have to keep reminding ourselves.
Yeah.
Our faith is not in the bridge.
Exactly.
Our faith is that God will be there for us the whole time, one way or the other.
Right. Yeah.
So, and that's the thing. Yeah, that's the thing about science, though. It's
it's like technology now, huh? I don't know that we're worried all that much about science, although maybe we ought to be. But
I heard about those CRISPR things on Radiolab. I'm worried.
All right, tell me what the CRISPR things are.
Well, they've, you know, done so much mapping of now, Chris. This is Rose and Tom told me about this, so. Uh-huh. Yeah. But they've done so much mapping of everything. They found the spots where, like, the genes will fix themselves if something goes wrong.
Okay, so we're talking genetics. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And so what they're doing is going, some people are like, well, we have to be very careful with this, which I'm like, yes. And other people are going, oh, my gosh, I can make a cat with wings. And I'm like, no.
Right.
Or, ooh, what we can do for human beings. I'm like, well, wait, hold on. What are you talking about here? Because then I'm like, for every person who's like, I just want to help people who to not have scoliosis when they're born or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There are the people who are like, and now I'm going to make the next Superman because I know what people should be. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
The same thing that says, let's
Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, exactly.
Right back to it. Yeah.
Let's get rid of, let's have abortions because we don't want any Down syndrome children versus, you know, how can we make their lives more wonderful and what do they do for us?
Hmm.
It's the same, to me, kind of thinking.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, so.
So you're saying that the fact that they're finding these genes and they're starting to manipulate them, that's scary stuff.
To me.
Yeah, well, to me yes. too. Yeah, I agree with that. And that's what I said maybe we should. It's like all the talk, my point was, is that, you know, all the talk that we hear is really about technology and the flow, the tidal wave of stuff we have coming at us all the time and trying not to get mired. Try not to live your life on Twitter, you know, or trying not to do things that look good on Twitter just because they look good on Twitter or whatever it might be.
And again, I think that puts us in there with the Victorians because they had the telegraph, which was like the internet for them.
Mm-hmm.
I saw some quote that somebody had pulled where it was a newspaper or something talking about these young people with this instantaneous communication. This is really awful. And they're doing things just to talk about it. And they were talking about the telegraph.
Hmm. Yeah, and that's interesting too. Yeah, I don't want to come off as I think we're going through a change here. I don't know what's on the other side of this,
right?
But that's right. Yeah,
and those transitional times, they're both wonderful and scary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easy when you look back. You look back and you go, oh, well, Cuba and the Missile Crisis. You know, no,
but I have found, you know, I've gone through waves. You know, we've been doing this for almost 4 years now.
Yeah.
And I went through a period of time where I was going to get rid of all the books. Right.
I remember you saying that.
And I was going to go all digital, and therefore I was going to be very light and, you know, essentialist, I guess. Right.
Yeah.
But the truth is that really doesn't help at all because, first of all, you still have, you know, if you have 100 books online, that's the same as having 100 books on the shelf. Right.
I guess it is,
it weighs
isn't it?
The same on your head. I can tell you that from experience. And but the other thing is that there's something for me about unplugging that is effective. Whether that's true for my daughter or not, I have no idea, right? But for me to put the phone down and the computer down and all that and open up a book is it works very well. It's I can't even think of what I'm trying to say about it. It's more relaxing or it's more disconnecting or somehow I'm able to shut off a part of my brain that's normally on all day or whatever it is. But sitting down and opening up a hard copy of a book is rewarding in a way that the Kindle wasn't.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know why, but so that's kind of where I'm at now. And I don't know that that'll be true in the, for people in 50 years. But, you know, you can see, I feel that, and maybe you know the data on this, because I know you're plugged into this industry a little bit, is the book industry. It seems as though the book industry has plateaued in their dip as far as bookstores.
Oh, I don't know. Well, yeah, there's so few.
Few, but I don't know that, like Barnes & Noble, I think they're doing okay. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I haven't paid attention.
It seems like, you know, they're surviving fine. I know when I go to Barnes & Noble, they are busy.
Yeah. I was just in one the other day, and it was super packed. Also, I was in Half Price Books. Really busy. We were in line for a little while.
So, I mean, that maybe, you know, I don't have any data to back it up at all. But it seems to me that there people have found value in them. It's just like, you know, everybody was worried about libraries when the internet came about. And somehow libraries seem more vibrant now than they did back then. There's something that they made a transition and they're doing something that's
TV
bringing
came
people
along,
in there.
Everybody was worried about the movies. The movies came along. Everybody's worried about the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, all those things have changed in reaction to the stresses that something new puts on them. But they're essentially all still telling us stories of some sort or providing whatever entertainment. And I have to agree with you about books, and I think I might have said this before, but I was visiting my mom in Florida, and I was like, oh, I'm going to be smart and travel light and just take stuff on the Kindle because I have so much there. And I got so crabby about the fourth day of just reading on the Kindle, I couldn't stand it. And it took me a while to go, I can't take reading on this thing anymore. I had to go look through my sister's bookcases and go, oh, here's a book. And I don't know why, again, like you, but I was thinking when you said, I don't know why, and I was trying to analyze, and I'm like, you know, some things you just can't analyze. Some things you just go, that's the way it is.
Yeah, sure. Yep, and could I be just because I got used to it growing up. You know, who knows what?
Well, I think, you know, we like to do that thing where we feel like we should overcome everything because, you know, this isn't any different than that, but our bodies can tell the difference. Hmm. And there are things about us as animals that react differently. You know, you go outside and it's just refreshing, usually, if the weather's okay. We don't know why. And some scientists would break it down to, well, you know, your skin feels this and from the sun and the air and moving and, you know, you see this, the colors are vibrant or whatever. But we're not. That doesn't matter to us. We experience it. And I think the book is an experience. And I think maybe that's the problem with Jekyll. He was trying to divide himself into something that could just have those experiences, and he thought it wouldn't affect him otherwise.
Yeah, and that's true. Didn't Jekyll say that to have these two things separate and existing would make a man very happy?
Yeah.
Right?
In fact, that's why he was pursuing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it turned out it did not.
No. Well, and it's funny because that takes us back to, I wanted to read the transformation scene.
Oh, please do.
Because one of the things that affected me was not only this transformation scene, which, as I've said, is you see it echoed everywhere, but Lanyon's reaction to it. Because it gives him a shock that kills him eventually. And that's another thing where you'd go, well, that just doesn't make sense. But, you know, there's some things that just affect you in a way that you can't describe. Mm. Or more than you can just break down and describe all the time. So anyway, he, meaning Jekyll, or Hyde, sorry, put the glass to his lips and drank at one gulp. A cry followed. He reeled, staggered, clutched at the table and held on, staring with injected eyes, gasping with open mouth. And as I looked, there came, I thought, a change. He seemed to swell. His face became suddenly black, and the features seemed to melt and alter. And the next moment I had sprung to my feet and leaped back against the wall, my arm raised to shield me from that prodigy, my mind submerged in terror. Oh, God, I screamed, and oh, God, again and again, for there before my eyes, pale and shaken and half fainting and groping before him with his hands like a man restored from death, there stood Henry Jekyll. And you think
very
about it.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Think the first time anybody read this stuff. Wait, what?
Now you read that and I think Rick Baker in American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
You know, he was the makeup guru back then. The monster man, right?
Yeah, but think about it. He seemed to swell. His face became suddenly black, and the features seemed to melt and alter. Yeah, that's as current as you can get.
Yeah.
You still read stuff like that and see stuff like that.
You're right. Yeah.
But that's,
and it's just as unsettling now as it was then, probably.
Yeah.
It is unsettling.
Well, and then because Lanyon then says what he is told by Jekyll everything, and he says, I saw what I saw, I heard what I heard, and my soul sickened at it. And yet now, when that sight has faded from my eyes, I ask myself if I believe it, and I cannot answer. My life is shaken to its roots. Sleep has left me. The deadliest terror sits by me at all hours of the day and night. I feel that my days are numbered and that I must die. And yet, I shall die incredulous. Hmm. Now, how's that? He saw it.
Yeah.
And it was so amazing. He can't believe it. And think of how many times we absolutely know something has happened. And then we turn around and start to question ourselves.
Yeah. I was thinking too, you know, Lanyon and he were having the scientific fight and, and Lanyon just saw something that he can't explain with his knowledge. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that broke him.
Mm-hmm.
So really that's interesting from that perspective too, from a, you know, a forbidden knowledge type of a standpoint.
Yeah. Well, plus, yeah, because then he's like, oh, my good friend is the one who killed Carew. But also, think about witnessing just like right across the room from you what he said.
Yeah.
And then you still, and you're just horrified and it's giving you horrible nightmares, but you're still going, but it's so ridiculous. I don't really think it's true. And I was like, that's such a modern way to think about it. And maybe it's not that modern. Maybe we just think we're so modern and people would have still felt that way. But I think it's kind of something to do with that Victorian age that you were talking about, that break between believing magic and the fantastic versus this is an age of reason, like you're saying, you know.
Yeah.
Had 200 years before, would they have had that problem? I don't know.
I don't know either.
I think they'd have just gone, yeah, okay.
Yeah, very interesting. Cool. Well, thanks for picking this book.
Oh, well, I'm glad you liked it.
It was one of those things that I'm just very happy to have read.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah.
Oh, I did want to say one more thing.
Please do.
Mm-hmm. I had the weirdest experience thinking about this book the other day. I was walking along, and I was thinking about imaginative prayer, you know, Saint Ignatius, the whole idea of you put yourself in a piece of scripture and that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, right.
And I was thinking about this book that way. And I thought about how Jekyll embraced evil and longed to do the things he desired. And I thought, what if I was like Hyde and I could choose to be all evil? What would I do? And you know what's funny? The second that entered my mind, and this is the thing that sounds stupid, but I'll just share it anyway. I had this moment of terror shoot through me.
Oh, wow.
Talk about things you can't explain. It was like my soul was going, no, 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 no. There lies danger, cliff, fence. Right. Don't go there. But it was the weirdest thing that it made me kind of stop in my tracks because I just was so taken by surprise. It was this instinctive, no. I mean, I was terrified.
Wow.
And then I couldn't get that out of my mind for at least a day. My mind kept going back to, well, but what if you thought? And I was like, no, not going to even think about it. Because, you know, Catholic teachings is that we're all naturally good. Now, we may have been all damaged somehow, some of us more than others for various reasons or genetics or, you know, meaning people who are amoral or something and can't help themselves. But I mean, but at root, we all want to be good. And so the idea of being somebody like Jekyll, who's like, hoo, 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 I want to do these bad things. So how can I make it so I can do them?
Wow.
It's obviously, to me, a more naturally terrifying thing when I think about it for myself than I would have realized. I don't know. It's just weird.
Yeah. Very interesting. Wow. That is wild.
Wasn't that crazy?
Yeah.
I just was like, wow, okay, not going to go there. Going to take that as a warning.
Hello. Yeah.
So I'm from way down deep. I don't know what it is.
I listened to that one.
Yeah, I did. I just like, because, and especially because I was so surprised. Okay.
Wow.
There be dragons.
That's right. Yeah, wow, so. That's fascinating. Thanks for sharing that. That's something else. Wow.
I know. I'm sorry. I just
no. Don't be sorry. Goodness. I just think that that's amazing. It's good
stuff.
Yeah.
So don't anybody do that experiment at home.
Right. Absolutely. Well, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, is that everything about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
It was for me.
I
was
think
it
so.
For you?
Yeah, it was for me. Okay. And again, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, I really did. Yeah, add that to my shelf of stuff that I'm happy to have read on this podcast. That list is long.
I know, for me too. I was looking through it the other day thinking, wow, we've read so many great books.
We've done a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Well, cool. All right, so next up, we're still in October on our next podcast. Yeah. And we're going to watch Halloween, John Carpenter's original movie, which is terrific, Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's from the 70s, I think.
Yeah.
79, I'm guessing, but I'm not positive. All right.
We'll tell everybody later. They can be in suspense until then.
Okay, excellent. I remember bell bottoms, so I'm guessing.
Yeah, and I feel like Jamie Lee Curtis was wearing knee socks, which is just so funny to think about now. But anyway.
I like it. All right. And then the podcast after that, we're going to talk about The City by Dean Koontz.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that's going to be great.
Right. That is going to be good.
Very fun. And then after that, we're going to go into James Bond territory. We're going to talk about Skyfall and whatever else Bond might come up.
Oh, yes. I saw an ad for the new one, and yeah, I wasn't Spectre. That interested. And then I saw the ad. Oh, crazy.
Good stuff. Cool.
That guy from Spectre is wearing a 1970s style, super cool jacket and shirt. I'm just going to say, and hairstyle. I just love it. It's so
great.
Oh,
I like it. Very nice.
That's from the past.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Cool. And then after that, we're into December. So we've got the rest of the year planned here.
Oh, yeah.
The rest after that, we're in December. We're going to do two books at once. Leaf by Niggle by J.R. Tolkien and The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis.
Right.
I love that. That's
Leaf
be
by
fun.
Niggle is really a short story. So
yeah, right.
It's in something else.
Okay. You know? And then the last one of the year is going to be Millions, a movie called Millions. Which I know nothing about, so that's going to be great.
Really?
Yep. Oh, I don't.
Very excited.
All right. Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes.
I hope
you
enjoyed and enjoy your October. Go read you some Bradbury or something.
Yes, or something else scary.
Yes.
Frankenstein.
Watch The Sixth Sense.
pick up a lovely book with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in it, and I might have the Body Snatchers in there and Markheim, two other excellent stories by the master.
Okay, you're saying the Body Snatchers? Because I've got some short stories. I got to make sure.
It's just for nothing but scaring you.
All right.
No morality. Well, there's a little morality, but no real morality there. And Markheim is kind of like the bookend, I think, to Jekyll and Hyde.
Cool.
It's the other perspective in a sense.
Okay, noted. So, I'm going to get those read. All right. Well, thank you again.
Okay, thanks, everyone.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. Yep. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.